yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yeah, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found. Whose crimes have gone unpunished now. Walk the streets a screaming now. They brought death to our hometown. Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, we're back on the air here. We've been off a little bit here for the last couple of weeks, as you no doubt know. PRN had some issues with its offices, some weather problems, and they had to move, and then there were phones being put in and so forth. So I have not been live the last several weeks, but now we are live. We're back. And we're going to start talking anew on no loss of important issues here, particularly in the U.S. and global economy and what's going on with Congress and how they're now attacking Social Security, Medicare more directly, TPP, you know, Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement is on the hot burner here. Situations are intensifying in the Ukraine and in Greece. The global economy, China is slowing, and we're going to see very soon that, the so-called U.S. recovery is now back on track with its stagnation long-term trend here. Yes, we'll talk about that next week. And, this week, we have two topics this week. One, I want to talk about a new initiative, online education initiative called Z School, Z, letter Z School. And I have a guest, Michael Albert, who's going to join me. We're going to talk about Z School, and I'll say a few things about it shortly here. And then in the first half of the hour, in the second half of the hour, I want to talk about a topic which I call intensifying intercapitalist competition. Things seem to be changing after 5-6 years of no or slow growth, and the global economy seems to be slipping once again. And imminently here this year sometime, I predict we're going to see a big contraction here in stock and bond markets. We'll talk about that some more, and it's going to be quite a shock for folks, I think, to realize, all this hype about the U.S. recovery is just that, it's hype. And situations are now deteriorating. But we'll talk about that next week in particular. Next week I want to talk about the USA economy, what's really happening with the economy. We'll have the new preliminary report for first quarter 15 GDP, and we're going to see it comes in less than 2%, I'm going to predict. And that's a big drop from all this hype of last fall of 5% growth rate, which is really just a 5% last fall was just a recovering of the negative GDP growth that occurred earlier last year. So the U.S. economy is still on this stop-go, growing less than 2% average long-term if you look at it, and about to confront some very serious new headwinds that could slow the economy significantly even further here. In other words, cutting off all this so-called recovery. So we're going to talk more about that in relation next week to China's continuing slowdown, to Japan's recession and stagnation, to the failure of QE in Japan and the soon failure of QE in Europe as well. Okay, so that's next week. Next week we'll talk about the U.S. economy in a global context. I also want to talk in subsequent weeks about the Ukraine. It will be a year now in April, May 2015, since the IMF introduced its recovery package in the Ukraine, and Ukraine has continued to descend into a deeper depression ever since. Economically, Ukraine is even worse than it was a year ago, and that's after a year of IMF rescue. And, of course, the latest news is the IMF is going to now have to up its rescue from the $17 billion last year to more than $40 billion this year. And we'll revisit my prediction last year where I said they'll have to spend at least $50 billion. Well, who's going to spend the $50 billion is the question. So we'll talk about Ukraine next month in April. I also want to talk about TPP and the fast track. That's coming to a head here, Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade on Steroids Agreement. That's going to be a big issue in the U.S. here next month. And I also want to talk about the U.S. Congress and its budgets, dueling budgets we got going on here, and the new attack on Medicare and Social Security in recent days. You may not have heard, but in this new ACA and government budget, they're going to up the cost of Medicare by 20%. Okay, all you retirees out there, listen clear. Medicare, cost increase, 20% out of pocket. You're not going to be able to buy insurance for Part B physicians anymore. You're going to have to pay out of pocket. Yeah, this is all about holding down health care costs by rationing. That's what it's about, and passing the cost onto the shoulders of consumers and workers, which is intensifying now. And, of course, Democrats going along with it, Obama going along with it. So we got to visit that topic here in Congress and budgets, as well as TPP next month, as well as Ukraine. And then I also want in May to start talking about my new book that's coming out, which is called Systemic Fragility in the Global Economy. So that's where we're going. But today we want to have two topics here. In the first half, I want to talk about Z-School. In the second half of the show, we'll talk about intercapitalist competitions. And I have a guest here, Michael Albert. Michael, are you there?
Yeah, I am.
Okay, Michael. A little intro of Michael. Michael's been a longtime progressive and radical activist and intellectual theoretician and, you know, author, etc. Been associated with the Z Collective. Maybe that's wrong, but the Z Group for decades now. They've been putting out this wonderful magazine called Z-Mag for decades now, and in recent years established a great global blog called ZNet. You might want to check it out, ZNet, where writers from all over the world send in their analyses of what's happening globally in their areas and other areas. Just about every topic of real interest politically today is on ZNet. So check out ZNet and check out ZMag if you haven't. But we have two new initiatives by Z. One is this relationship with Telesaur TV. Telesaur TV is a new media network established last year in Latin America by several countries to counter the propaganda of the U.S. And it's really a professionally well done effort here. And Z, Michael, and his Z writers, ZNet writers, have a agreement to produce articles for Telesaur. And every week, you know, there's a number of opinion articles by ZNet writers for Telesaur. So check that out as well. And maybe Michael will say a few words on that. But I really want Michael to talk about Z School, the latest effort of the Z Group here, an online radical progressive education forum, you might say. So why is a progressive left radical online school necessary? Well, you know, the lies and confusion that's being propagated by the capitalist press is intensifying. Now, you're not going to find out really what's going on, or even the truth, by listening to and reading capitalist media here. There's a real need for a kind of online radical school here. Now, you can get short-term information of what's going on in the blogs, like in ZNet, and here on PRN Radio, and, you know, progressive radio, alternative radio, and so forth. But what we need is even more analysis, a deeper analysis, not just information. We need an analysis to understand deeply the issues and the problems. We need to go deeper. We need to educate ourselves, then act. You know, one of the bane of American progressive and left politics, I've said for a long time, is this frenetic turn to action. Action for its own sake. And not thinking out the key questions and what is the proper, most useful strategy, tactics. What are the organizational questions? What are the alliances and so forth? What's a program of the left here? You know, you look around, I don't see any real programmatic definition for the left in the U.S. and vision as well. You know, where you got a program, but where are you taking it? What do you hope to achieve at some point down the future? So, you know, program and vision and strategy, tactics, organizational questions, that can't be adequately addressed on blogs or even on radio and so forth. It takes a deeper analysis. I think that's what Z-School is about, isn't it, Michael?
Yes, very much so. It's a good introduction to it. I would go a little further in one respect. It's one thing for an individual or even a couple of people to explore a set of ideas and move forward in some direction, whether it's analysis of what's going on, understanding finances, or understanding the way racism manifests in society, whatever it might be. Or even to a person develop a vision of what one wants, what you were talking about in the form of, well, this is what we want to get, this is what we want to achieve, this is what our program should lead to, or strategy. It's one thing to do it yourself, and it's another thing to do it more collectively by sharing the information where, in a course, people share the information, prod each other, learn from each other, push the whole thing forward, and develop a capacity and a facility to communicate with others about it. If what we do when the left educates itself is generate a whole lot of brains that are walking around with some interesting analysis and information and vision and strategy located inside them, but they can't communicate it to others, and they can't share it with others, and they can't work together with others to implement it, well, then what's the point? What does one achieve? I mean, maybe from the point of view of personal ratification, it's nice, but from the point of view of changing society, it's pretty much irrelevant. So the idea of the school, I think, is both to provide a place where it's possible to have that personal ratification, to explore further, to learn, to become competent and adept at communicating and at utilizing information, and then also it becomes a kind of a community, a kind of a venue of people sharing and of becoming excellent, I hope, at communicating with others and therefore spreading the ideas. And in that sense, I think it's a kind of a much, much more in-depth approach to social networking, even as it's an approach to education.
Can you tell us how Z-School, the idea started here with, Z and your mind and so forth? Why did you decide to do this?
Well, it's actually not the first time. Some years back, I don't remember how long ago, we did something similar, and we did it for a while, and it worked. But it didn't grow large enough, and many other functions called, and it began to wear out, and we stopped. And so it's, in a sense, rebirthing something that we do have some experience with already. But the idea is really, it's straightforward. This isn't, advanced quantum mechanics to come up with the idea that we need to be able to educate ourselves and we need to be able to share what we learn. It's more a question of, do we have the time and energy and the resources to do it? And what's fascinating about the effort to do the school was that when we embarked on it, we didn't know whether we'd even generate something that we could show people. So in other words, before you can actually do an online school, you have to construct an online venue where it could happen. And that venue has to be good enough. It has to be congenial enough, friendly enough to use, able to convey information, able to have people share, and on and on. And it turned out the technology is no big deal. It's quite doable. It uses something called Moodle, which is what universities use, and you know, other entities that create online schools, including huge ones, use. So it's highly, you know, it's had a lot of track of wear and tear, and it's been worked in, and it really does work. So that's the first thing we learned. Okay, it's technically possible to do it. Now there was another step. Will people teach? So, again, it doesn't do any good to have a venue and to not have content. And to have content, you have to have faculty who are willing to spend the time to prepare courses for this particular format, to be online, to be able to interact with people and engage with them online. And so the next step was basically I contacted a variety of people. Now, I honestly thought I was going to have to contact a whole lot of people to get enough courses to do a first session. And I started with just a bunch. I don't remember how many was in the first bunch, but maybe 20, 25, something like that. And I thought what would happen is, well, a few people would say yes, and then I'd have to go out and get some more. But what happened is the first bunch was enough. We had 14 courses from the first bunch from, I think it's eight faculty. And on top of that, there was another 7 faculty, so 15 altogether, who were pledging courses to be added in the second session. They just couldn't do them fast enough. And fast enough was really quick. That is to say, when I contacted people, they only had 5-6 weeks before the thing was going to be, it needed to be in shape. It needed to be up and able to be looked at. So they had very little time to prepare their courses. Nonetheless, the faculty did it, prepared the courses, and put them up. And what we learned was, okay, it's technically possible, the venue is possible, and faculty is possible. Really high-quality faculty are willing to do this. So the question that now remains is students, honestly. The question that remains is if the left prepares and presents and offers a school, an online school, of very high quality in both substance and technique, will leftists, will students, will people, potential students out there, make use of it? And that's what we don't know for sure. So far, the biggest impediment to that appears to be time. And it really is, I think, an important lesson to take. I've started writing to people asking them about, well, what's your reaction to this? And the reaction has been uniformly, this is a terrific idea, it's wonderful, it's really great, I wish I could do it, but I don't have enough time. Over and over and over again, time. And there's something important there, because what it really says is, beyond caring for my household, whatever it might be, and beyond doing my job, and beyond other responsibilities which I simply don't know how to do anything about other than to do them, I have no time. I have no time for this, I have no time for activism, I have no time, etc. And this is an important piece of information, it seems to me. If you want to change the world and people say to you, well, I can't do it because, you know, I'm cold, then the movement to change the world better provide sweaters. If people say to you, I can't do it because I have no time, then movements have to find a way to give people time. And so that's the next thing we have to try and work on. Regrettably, I think it can't be done, you know, by a single entity, a project that's trying to put up a school. I think it takes movements that make demands about the length of the work week. But I suspect that without that, it's going to be hard to start new projects that are really substantive.
Well, talking about time here, let me just interject and say the school, for listeners here, to the show, the school is about to launch. In other words, it's not mm-hmm. ongoing. You can jump in and perhaps you find a class or course you find particularly interesting. It really launches next week, I believe, first week of April. So folks listen to the show, if you are interested, you know, there still is time to check out the courses and who is talking, who is teaching them, and, you know, maybe try one out. Can you comment on that? Where might listeners go to see what the courses and who the teachers are? I mean, they're all seasoned progressives and activists and so forth. I mean, these aren't your, you know, your academic types, you know, who know their little niche information that's totally irrelevant to what's going on in the world. I mean, these are people who have been active, many of them like yourself, Michael, for a long time and have a wealth of experience and yet are teaching a course that, you know, is not just about doing stuff, but understanding and doing stuff politically here. Tell us more about where they go, first of all, and you know, the logistics, the details. I know you have, like, different degrees of participants, you know, observers and so forth. Can you explain that to folks and where to go?
Sure. Well, first off, the easiest way to find out anything that any of your listeners want to learn about this is to just go to the site. And rather than give you a long URL, which is hard to remember, all you have to do is go on Google and look up Z School. It'll pop up quickly near the top. And the other thing you can do is go to ZNet, if you're familiar with that, because as you arrive at ZNet, there's an overlay which will take you to Z School if you want to go there. So that's easy. So once you get to Z School, one thing to keep in mind is online education isn't like going to a class in the real, you know, brick-and-mortar world. When you go to a brick-and-mortar class, not only do you have to get to the building, but you got to go into it when other people are in it as well. So, in other words, it operates on a schedule. You might have a class at a particular time of the day, a particular number of days a week, and so on. But when you do an online educational program, it doesn't work that way. So, for instance, Jack, you've been quiet about the fact that you're teaching a course, but you are. And if somebody takes your course in Z School, they don't come and interact with you on Thursday afternoon from 4 to 5. Rather, your whole course is online 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And what happens is while you cover it, while you go through it sort of a week at a time, people have access to it all the time. So they basically engage with it whenever they want, whenever they have time and interest and energy to look in on it. And the way they interact with you personally is they ask you a question, but they don't ask you a question in class by raising their hand. They ask you a question by writing it in what's called a forum, and you answer it. And they see the answer and read it when they wish to. And they interact with other students in the same fashion. So there's three levels of participation. There's what you might call basic or full fee participation. It's just, you know, you sign up to be a student in a course, and it's the full fee, and it's $100. And the course is run for 8 weeks. Another level is to sign up for a course low income. It's exactly the same experience. You get the same thing. You get access to the whole course, et cetera, but it's half as much. It costs $50 for the 8 weeks. And the third possible thing that one can do is to be an observer. And this is a little different. In this case, you sign up and you can read everything and you can see everything when there are videos and so on. And you can even see questions that somebody else asks to the faculty and the faculty answer, or discussion among other students. But you can't yourself discuss and you can't yourself ask questions. So in other words, you can't interact with it. You can't basically put an added burden on the faculty person to relate to you, and that's only $30. And so those three levels all exist. I can't remember if you had some other question that was part of that.
No, it sounds quite reasonable, you know, with the outrageous cost of formal education in these institutions today. You know, all I can say is that, you know, if you become a join Z-School, we're not going to provide you with Olympic swimming pools and student unions with climbing walls.
In fact, I haven't told you yet, but we are.
Oh, we are? Okay, tell me.
I'm kidding.
Okay.
But it is interesting that one of the people who I wrote to who said that they had an answer for why people didn't sign up, why a particular person might not sign up. And this person said, well, you don't have the reputation Harvard has. So I wrote back and I said, you know, when you think about that, it's sort of interesting. Harvard is competing with 10,000 other colleges. And if you want to, you could say Harvard is competing with, let's say, 15 or 20 other, you know, totally top-ranked colleges in the United States. forget, set politics aside, it's still the case that Harvard is competing with all these other entities, and one reason why somebody might not go to Harvard is to go someplace else. And you have to pay $30,000 or $40,000 a year. The school is competing with nobody. That is to say, this school, this offering of deep and thorough discussion and exploration of ideas associated with understanding and changing the world in a manner that, you know, doesn't impose a strict timeline and doesn't cost much, well, there is no other variant. That's it. You can do this or you cannot do this, but it's not, you know, as if there are 16 of these schools. That's the problem. And that is important, I think, to keep in mind. And when we get to this question of can we succeed with this or not, technically we can succeed. Timeline of our own activity, we can succeed. Substance, faculty, we can succeed. The real question is, can we communicate with the audience enough for them to know it's there, that you're helping with right now? And even more so, can we help people find the time to invest in improving their ability to communicate about the world and try and change it?
Well, I guess it's a question of priority. If you really are concerned with what's going on and how and why it's getting worse and how it may impact you, you find the time. You know, when you have to deal with negotiations in your union and in dealing with management, you have to put some personal things aside if it's important enough to you, and you have to find the time. So, you know, folks who say we don't have the time, maybe they're not that all committed to change, because I presume, given from the faculty here and so forth, I mean, people in this school are dedicated to change, and that's an important bottom line. Can you tell us maybe just a few selections of the type of people who are teaching some of these courses and
sure,
a couple examples of the course? I mean, you don't have to list them all, but, you know, just to give folks a sense of what is this school offering?
Sure. Well, I mean, obviously folks know you, so that's one case. Eva Gollinger is teaching a course on Latin American revolutions. The next term, another couple of courses. She's not just a longtime activist, she's been deeply involved in Latin America. She was in Venezuela for a long time, and maintains connections with the Bolivarian movements and so on. She's also a lawyer. She's also a single mother in New York, I think, finding time.
By the way, let me interject. She's been writing some very excellent articles in ZNet on U.S. strategy to destabilize Venezuela right now. So, but excuse me, I just
she's
had to give a plug for her. She's very good. Yeah,
yeah. Justin Potter is good on lots of topics, but happens to be teaching a course on tools for security. In other words, cyber tools. How do people maintain their privacy? How do people protect against snooping? How do you function in the current society if you want to understand the alternative to everything that you're doing becoming the property of the government? And so it's a very much a how-to course. I'm teaching courses. I actually am teaching three of them. One on economic vision, one on societal vision, various aspects of society, not just economy, and a third course on sort of an intellectual framework for activism, conceptual tools for being able to look at events and develop strategy. let's see. There's a course by a person who's very active in solidarity with Greece, about Syriza. So you can see courses are very timely. I mean, in a sense, it's sort of lucky. I mean, it wasn't as if we planned for 2 years and then generated the courses. Even on very short notice, we got courses on everything that's timely. So cyber secrecy and spying, very timely. Your course on the financial circumstances in the U.S. and in the world, very timely. The Latin American intervention course, given what's going on right now, incredibly timely. Let's see what else. There's a course on investigative journalism, a course on militant resources, research, a course on anarchism, a course on communities of resistance, one on ecology and resistance again, one on international relations and international law. I don't know, I may be leaving something out. Probably am.
And the C school runs 8 weeks, and then it'll run another 8 weeks with new courses during the summer, and then again 8 weeks afterwards, right? Is that the...
Well, there'll be a month off in between each. So in other words, it'll run 8 weeks, April and May. Then June is off. the material will still be there for people to look at. But June, basically, you sign up the next set of students, and you sign up additional courses. Most of the faculty will repeat their course. So I suspect that we have 14 courses in the first April-May session. If everything goes well, I suspect we'll have 25 courses offered in, I guess it's July, August, with June off, and then September off, and then October, November will be, again, a new set of courses. But all the time, the student community grows. Once you're a student, you maintain that sort of status, I guess you could call it, and you constantly have access to the school per se, although you have to enroll in specific courses that you might wish to take.
Are there any discounts for taking additional subsequent second, third courses or something like that?
Well, we haven't done that yet. I mean,
okay.
The truth of the situation is everything depends on scale. I mean, if anybody thinks about this, they can think about it really quickly and sort of come to some obvious conclusions, I think. So, for example, Joe, or in your case, Jack, teaches a course. What does Jack have to do? Well, he's got to prepare a whole course. He's got to prepare 8 weeks' worth of substantive content, and then he's got to interact with students over the course of those 8 weeks. Now, it doesn't mean that he's going to spend every minute of every day interacting, but it's substantial. So the people who are doing this, in order to do it, are going to need to feel that there's something very positive coming from it, a community of people who are learning and who are developing and who are, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. Now suppose that there's a certain number of people taking courses. Well, if there's on average 40 people in a class, that would be one thing. If there were on average 200 or 300 people in a class, that would be something very different. And depending upon what there is, prices will change. We're not trying to collect a gargantuan sum of wealth, you know, to put in swimming pools, as you said. So if there are sufficient people signing up, not only will there be a low-income fee and an observer fee and a full-price fee, but all the fees will just start to move down. And nonetheless, there'll be more than enough revenues for faculty and for the institution as a whole. And indeed, one way to do that might be to give discounts for subsequent courses in addition to lower rates and so on. There's really a tremendous amount of potential, but of course it's only real if people relate. If there were, well, I mean, it's easy to see. Suppose there were 1,000 people taking courses, because there's 50 classes, right? It's not as if you have to have all that many people per class. If there's 50 classes, and now we're talking 20 people in a class, it's already 1,000 people taking courses. If there were 100 people in a class, and there were 100 classes, you have 10,000 students. If there were 10,000 students and they were paying $50 a piece, 10,000 times $50 is what? $500,000. 4 times a year is $2 million a year. There is a gigantic amount of resources here, and as a result, we can take much less. The faculty would be getting good income and would be able to help finance their various activities that they're all engaged in. Z would be giving money away. This is a mechanism which is oddly capable not only of a very good service, education, sharing of knowledge, sharing of vision, etc., but of a sort of a resource mechanism for the left.
Mm-hmm.
If you want my real vision of it, my real vision of it is, or my full vision of it is, that it isn't really just the school. The school would be one component. And then you could have a Democracy Now! School, so-called DN school, and a Progressive School, P school, a Syriza school, a Bolivarian school, and so on and so forth. So in other words, organization after organization would sponsor or would host a subset of courses. It's still just one big entity. But now what happens is each of these organizations is hosting a subset of the courses, probably on things that their reps and their acts and their, you know, educators are primarily interested in. And it is divided among all these organizations, as well as among the faculty, on top of
learning. I can see tremendous potential, as you describe it, in other areas. For example, as you're talking, I'm thinking, you know, if we could get some folks to teach labor organizing, you know, get someone in from the $15 movement, you know, $15 wage movement, which is growing fast. And how about contingent faculty organizing and bargaining, which I'm directly involved in here as well. And it can be like a magnet where people can come and find out what other people who are fighting the same fight elsewhere are doing successfully. And
that's
a pragmatic school about something useful, not something abstract, you know?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And what I think makes it potentially special is the thing that people think social working does, which social networking very rarely, in fact, does. And that's if you think about the picture that you were just putting forth, and that I was. If there's a Syriza one, and there's a Bolivarian one, and there's a Podemos one, different languages are not a problem, and there is various unions doing it, and there are various movements doing it, green movements and so on. What you have is an entity, a project, with a student body, if you will, that crosses borders and crosses constituencies, all sharing information, knowledge, and experiences, all able then to sponsor other activities. So you have a whole lot of potential here in which lots of different organizations can participate, and there's no need for any of these organizations to sort of conflict with one another about anything. There's nothing to fracture or to fragment the operation. It's just a mechanism that services the whole community. So there is a lot of potential, I think. I wish I could get it across in a way that a person thinking about whether or not to take a course would think about that. In other words, would think to themselves, well, when I invest some time in taking a course in this school, I'm actually doing two things. I'm getting the benefit that I directly get from it myself, from the course, but I'm also contributing to a project which may have a gigantic, broader effect over time, and I'm trying to help build it. And if I could get, a large enough number of students to sort of have that attitude about it, or even faculty to have that attitude about it, then I think it can take off. But without that, it's very difficult.
Well, let me just give a plug, since you mentioned I'm teaching a school, too. I'm teaching a course on finance capital in the 21st century, in which we're going to look at what is the nature of a global financial network, shadow banks and speculation and so forth, and is it leading to another financial crash? We'll look at specific events in the 90s and last decade and now brewing as well as look at Marx and Keynes and Minsky and others who were more theoretically attempting to look at that. So those of you who have been interested in following my views on the global economy would find my particular course of interest too. But I'm going to go out and talk to some union folks that I know of, Michael, and say, here's a format. Why don't we get somebody you know, teaching about how to organize contingent faculty. Why don't we get somebody from the fast food to talk about, you know, the teach a course on how to organize, you know, a living wage, a minimum wage, you know, and what others are doing. You make it very pragmatic and useful, I think. There's right. tremendous potential here. I'm going to see who I can stir some pots for you here.
Okay, excellent.
In that regard. Very good. Michael, thanks for coming on. We appreciate it. And, you know, maybe we'll have you back after the first Z-School sessions here. And once again, folks, it's not too late to join. To take a look at and see if, you know, there's something of interest there. You know, even, it's not, financially prohibitive, as Michael described, and you may have learned a lot. Just go to, Google Z School or ZNet, and, you'll be able to easily go from there, and, you'll be able to see, the courses that are offered in this first launch, and it's very easy to sign up, and, you know, you'll have an opportunity to interact with others and with the instructor, and I'm sure it'll be a very positive experience for very little money and effort. And, you know, if you have no money, you can just be an observer. Okay, go to Z-School, go to ZNet, and check it out. Check it out, folks. Okay, Michael, thanks again. We'll have you back soon.
Thank you, Jack.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, folks, we'll now shift to the second part of the show. As I said at the beginning, I want to say a few words about a topic here on the global economy that I've been writing about and focusing on a little bit more, and we will be revisiting time and again here in future weeks of the show, and that is, are intercapitalist rivalries intensifying? In other words, are the capitalists themselves beginning to fight amongst themselves more than before? Or in new ways, new aggressive ways? You know, competition is in the nature of capitalism here. And it's, you know, always intense. It's destructive. You know, capitalists are trying to grab each other's market share. They're cutting costs and prices. They're trying to get investment footholds in their competitors' home markets, you know, trying to get their product faster to market, introduce new product technologies and so forth. You know, we know the battles going on between Apple and Samsung, you know, on their iPhones and so forth. This is normal. This is always part of capitalism. And governments have always played a key role in helping their respective capitalists in the competition game. And in good times, you know, there's like rules of the competitive game that are established. They don't go beyond these rules. I've described some of the acceptable forms of competition. But when times are not so good, the competition gets more intense and it changes form. And ever since the crash of 2008-09, we've been kind of on that track of, you know, there. Capitalists are trying to find new ways to keep their head above water, and in doing so, they're sort of targeting each other more and going after each other's share of global profits and doing it in more aggressive ways that they hadn't done before. And that's kind of the theme that I'm raising here. And from my investigations in the world, watching the world economy, and its transition, you know, what I see is emerging new forms of more aggressive, intense competition. Well, what are some of these forms, some of these indications that competition is intensifying? You know, if you go back to the 1930s, there was a lot of intensified competition, and it actually ended up in wars as a result. That's the ultimate form of competition to get your government on your side and you know, it's conquest time to protect your markets, make sure you get your resources, you know, fight for your colonies versus theirs and all that stuff. So periodically the capitalists, you know, go off the deep end and they go to war with each other because of intense economic crises. And we saw that in the 30s, right? And, you know, after the 30s, the USA was dominant in the global economy, and most of the world looked to the U.S. you know, except for that part that was part of the communist, you know, Soviet Union, China. They were sort of outside the whole picture there. But there wasn't as intense competition because the other advanced capitalist economies were just trying to get on their feet, and the U.S. was the big dog. But now we see the others that are on their feet. You know, I'm looking at Europe and Japan and so forth. And the competition intensified, has been over the years, but now it's really getting intensifying as a result of the 2008 crash and the very slow global recovery that has occurred ever since. You know, in my new book coming out, I will attempt to document how this recovery is really far below, on a global scale, recoveries in the past. Something new has happened in the 21st century here. They can't get investment going. They can't really get jobs going like they used to. So what is it? What's really changed? And the structure has really changed quite a bit. But how has this led to more intensifying competition is the question, and new forms of competition. Well, if you look around and you look at what's going on with this QE, quantitative easing, right, and this monetary approach to try to get their economies going, especially in Europe and Japan, the weak links in the global capitalist system today, and which have been weak for the last 5-6 years, Japan even before that, well, they're resorting to this massive central bank money injections into their economies. And they say, oh, it's about getting inflation up. Well, that's nonsense. You know, what it's really about is driving their currencies down. If you drive your currency down, you get a competitive advantage for exports. What that means is that your export industries capture some of another country's export industries. You know, your exports are cheaper now, you sell more, so their industries and companies that were exporting sell less. It's a bigger their neighbor policy. Really, this whole QE drive down the currency and gain a competitive export advantage. And that's what we're seeing now happening. And that's something new. Because when they resort to beggar your neighbor, you know, that's kind of a new massive form of new kind of intense competitive pressure. Of course, their governments are on their side deeply involved in that. And usually when you see a capitalist government get involved deeply on behalf of its corporations, then you know that it's a serious issue. Right? Now, you can see that with the U.S. trying to push TPP and a European version of that, TTIP. Well, that's all about free trade, which means more U.S. corporate direct investment and getting around the national legislation in order to make profits and so forth. Well, you know, the QE and TPP and all this free trade push, big free trade push, mega free trade agreements, and QE to drive down exports is all about a new form of competition. The U.S. did it, and Britain, you know, its appendage, its economic appendage, followed suit back in 2009. We introduced QE, and we pumped almost $4 trillion plus printed money into the economy, and the U.S. dollar collapsed. And that gave the U.S. Manufacturing a competitive advantage. So it was try to get economic growth, GDP, up there by export stimulus, and try to stimulate export by, driving the currency down. And you need QE, massive money injection, to drive the currency down. Well, it worked sort of with the U.S. You know, back in 2010, it was all about we're going to get a manufacturing export-driven recovery. And Obama puts Jeff Immelt, CEO of General Electric, in charge of his economic policies, particularly his trade policies. And, of course, what we got from that was the TPP initiative. But we got a bunch of other initiatives to stimulate the U.S. exports as well. And we got a little boost in exports. And it helped a little bit of the recovery in the U.S. It was minimal. But then, of course, these exports were at the expense of the Europeans and the Japanese, oftentimes. The euro, the currency of the euro, went up to $1.40 in exchange rate to the U.S. dollar, $1.40. Well, that meant European exports just, sagged, globally, of course. By the way, that meant that Germany focused more on exporting to its periphery, in other words, Greece and Italy and so on and so forth. And Germany, of course, to allow those countries to buy German exports, lent them the money, German banks, German government, and so forth. And that's how we got this big debt problem in the southern periphery, particularly Greece. So Germany is the prime cause of the Greek debt, and now they're complaining that the Greeks won't pay the debt. Well, that's just an example of this intensifying export competition going on. That's one of the consequences of it, consequence of the U.S. QE and monetary policies to drive down the U.S. dollar. Well, the Europeans recently responded in kind. But before them, the Japanese did in 2013. They injected a massive QE and drove down the value of their currency, the yen, and got a little export advantage for a while. Well, with the U.S. And the U.K. and then Japan having done it, the Europeans, we have to do it too to stay in the competitive game. So what you got was $1.2 or $3 trillion announced, just introduced, Eurozone QE program. This all represents a new form of competition between the capitalists and beggaring each other's exports in a declining global trade environment, slowing global economy. They're all fighting amongst themselves more intensely and calling on their governments to help them stimulate their exports. But because the global total trade is slowing down, it stimulates your exports at the expense of somebody else's. You see, in the past, when the U.S. had total global economic hegemony, which is now slipping, they would have got together with the Europeans and the Japanese, and they all would have worked it out like they did in the 1980s. Okay, but now it's a different scenario here, and the forms of competition between them are intensifying. Another example of this intensifying competition here is between the U.S. and Russia over the Ukraine. I firmly believe that the U.S. provoked a coup in the Ukraine in order to try to provoke Russian intervention. And they want that Russian intervention, military intervention, as a way going to the rest of the Europeans and saying, oh, you got to intensify the sanctions against Russia. You see, the sanctions are really all about separating Russia off from the European economy. In the last decade, the U.S. has become increasingly concerned about the integration of the European economy and the Russians, not just over energy and oil and natural gas and so forth that comes from Russia that Europe's dependent upon, but the growing trade between particularly Germany and Italy and others with the Russians. You know, if the Russian economy becomes more integrated and more important to the Western Europeans, the U.S. influence over Western Europe economically declines commensurately here. So I think the U.S. Was getting worried about that deepening integration with Western Europe and Russia, and wanted to create a situation to provoke a crisis between Europe and Russia, and to evoke the sanctions which break off the integration between the two, and nothing better than the Ukraine. Of course, that's not the sole reason for going into Ukraine, but I think a major reason, and I think the U.S. Wants Russia to provoke more of a military conflict in Ukraine, because that would give the U.S. even more ammunition to say to the Europeans, look, you've got to up your sanctions here and sever your relationships with Russia. You look at Ukraine right now, a basket case, who's economically running Ukraine? It's two people appointed by the U.S. and the West here. Natalia Jureskova, who was a CEO for Well, Horizon Capital is a Chicago private equity firm in the U.S. She's put in charge. She's the finance minister of Ukraine right now. And another hedge fund guy tied in with European hedge funds. I forget his Lithuanian, very long last name. Abramovicius, I think it is. He's the economics minister. So those two people are really running the Ukraine right now, working with the IMF and the U.S. and the European Commission to try to keep Ukraine from totally collapsing economically, which it is close to. What this represents is that, the U.S. is more willing to engage in more intense, dangerous, adventurous forms of competition globally here. And the competition, of course, is between the U.S. and Russia over European economic influence. I mean, Europe has always been the backyard, economic backyard of the United States since World War II, but in recent decades that control has been slipping. It's a new form of competition, one that even resorts to political and military conflict. Another example of intensifying competition is the USA going after European banks and levying and extracting multi-billion-dollar fines and making it more costly for Euro banks to do business in the U.S. Euro, meaning not just Eurozone, but European, British, and so forth. The U.S. has been fining these banks because they are Wild West banking. London is the locale for Wild West banking now globally, as England or Britain becomes desperate here to maintain that one industry where it has some sort of influence globally, which is finance. But the U.S. has been fining these banks and stress testing even the European banks, Deutsche Bank, Santander in Spain, and so forth, and generally putting pressure on them and fining them billions and billions of dollars as a way of making U.S. banks more competitive. In other words, eliminating the competition by Euro banks in the U.S. Giving a hands up or heads up, leg up, whatever, to U.S. banks. So that would never happen before. The U.S. banks, U.S. regulators would not, and government would not go after Euro banks, a new form of intensifying competition. Now, the Europeans have responded in kind, have come right back and have gone after U.S. tech companies, Google, Microsoft, Uber, and so forth, Amazon, Facebook, targeting them. Sort of a tit for tat. You go after our banks, we'll go after your tech companies, and that represents a new form of competition, going after entire industries, not just companies, targeting entire industries. One capitalist sector, the U.S., targeting another, the European, and vice versa. That's a new form of competition. Another new form of competition, more intense, is what's going on with the global oil situation. What we've got clearly is Saudi Arabia and its Emirate neighbors going after shale producers in the U.S., which are competitive. And that's totally new as well on a global scale. And we see a global oil glut as a result of that. So, in short, we have new forms of intercapitalist competition intensifying, going on like they never did before. These problems would be resolved between all of them in the back door, back room, but now it's emerging. And we're going to see more of this intercapitalist intensification competition, the latest being China's Asian Industrial Investment Bank and the U.K. jumping on board, and all the Europeans jumping on board in direct challenge to the U.S. World Bank, controlled World Bank. So all these are new forms. Okay, next week we're going to talk about the U.S. economy and TPP and perhaps budgets. And the attack on Medicare and Social Security here. So we'll turn back to the U.S. next week. All right, this is Jack Lazarus, Alternative Vision. Talk to us again next week's show. We'll be live once again.